You're listening to the Franchise Podcast Network, presented by Lucky Star Casino. KRXO FM and KRXO HD Oklahoma City, a product of Tyler Media, reaching over 1 million Oklahomans every week. Now, the Outdoor Hour, giving you the inside scoop on the great outdoors on 107.7 The Franchise.
As long as I can remember, I've been drawn to the outdoors. There's something primal in each of us that awakens when we step outside the bounds of modern society and back into the vast possibilities of the natural world. The more civilized our lives become, the louder our hearts cry for reconnection with our native ways. Failure is imminent, dangers drawing nigh, but approached with reverence and tact, the outdoors return wisdom and gain. In both the outdoors and in life, harvests are fleeting, but lessons and memories abound. With that in mind, we step forth boldly together in pursuit of ourselves outdoors. We are nothing more than tree stand troubadours. Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. I'm excited this week. Oh no. Oh no. You tricked me.
He did the elevator. In studio, stood up. That was perfect.
So normally when
that
Josh
was solid,
when Josh
like
stands
that felt
up,
good. You know?
I know what to expect. I did not know today was a stand-up episode until we started, and suddenly, as I'm even just saying hello, the mic stand raises. Josh slowly elevates.
Elevated.
It was like a movie.
It was smooth.
I felt like Michael Myers was just popping up out of nowhere.
The smooth criminal over here. Call me MJ.
For sure. We had a good episode. I'm excited.
We got a great episode. I'm coming off of a cool weekend down in Sarasota, Florida.
Yep.
Running around with the X Insurance offshore boat racing team, which was a heck of a good time.
That's a totally different angle of outdoor stuff that we've not gotten into.
Yeah, no.
We might have to at some point.
I'll tell you, that's a world I'm not used to.
Speedboat racing?
Yeah, buddy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember that Hulk Hogan TV show where he was like a bounty hunter and he had a speedboat?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You just validated my soul. Thank you.
Yeah. Man, one of those classes, Supercat, those things go real fast, gentlemen.
Yeah.
The guys who I guess have been doing they've had a really good boat, but they've had one thing after the other happen and like haven't been able to complete a race this season yet. But this weekend it all panned out in their qualifying race. They hit 202 miles an hour around the course.
How far do they go? Is it like a drag strip kind of deal, or
no,
is it like an actual oval?
It's like an oval type shape. Okay. I'm still learning a lot about this, so don't quote me on any of it. But the different classes have different number of laps that they do, and some of them are like a staggered start, like they'll run three classes at the same time, but all of them are regulated in what they can, how fast they can go, or RPM regulations or horsepower regulations, and so they would never catch each other.
Yeah.
But the really, really fast ones, like Class 1 and Supercat, and they only go, they go by themselves, but yeah, wild.
Cool. Yeah, because if you crash one of those things, you're dead.
Nope.
Not anymore?
Nope.
That's kind of shocking.
Two have crashed this year. One almost crashed this weekend. I mean, wow. It was... It got real choppy.
Yeah. Almost turned into an airplane.
Oh, no, he did. He just throttled. So I didn't know this, too, and I don't want to distract from the episode, so I'm going to shut up here in a second. But they've got a driver, and then they have a throttle man.
Oh, okay. Two-man team.
Yeah, all of them. So the driver just drives. The other guy is power. So when they go in the air, they use throttle like motocross or dirt jump dudes use throttle to level out or, whatever, right, to try to save the day. And then they have these electronics in them that if things are about to go catastrophic, it kills the boat. It's called Guardian setting, and it can be triggered based upon a variety of things. But, yeah.
Interesting.
That's wild. Well, good. Glad you had a good time. I do want to do, like, let's do a whole episode talking about kind of what you're getting into out there.
Let's just go to the Keys in November as a team. We'll record from the
I don't like my
beach.
Family that much. Let's
I'm
go.
Down.
Yeah.
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 Cool.
Just joking. Well, I love you guys.
They don't listen anyways.
I know.
We got a great guest this week that I'm excited to bring into the conversation for a very different type of experience. Than being in the Keys and being on boats. My good friend from growing up is joining us. So this is the Outdoor Hour. I'm Taylor Maples. I just shot a bear.
But I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, enough said. That's Joshua Wildman Stratton.
Wildman Stratton.
The one and only. I feel like we need an alter ego intro for you on the stand-up days.
Yeah, something a little heavier.
Yeah, because that one doesn't really go hard enough for when you bring the juice.
It's been a couple months. I might do a refresh.
Yeah. Oh.
Autumn.
Okay.
Behind the glass, the one and only Matty Goldfish.
As I mess up my
Always
own intro.
Always baked an extra cheesy.
I love
that goldfish.
One job.
One job.
I know, right?
But listen, man, you've gone a really long time.
Yeah.
A really
Lizenby
long time.
Lizenby could never.
Wow. Even used his name. Not like former or.
No.
Dang.
No, Lizenby could never.
Roasted a dude, man.
On the phone this
choosing
week.
Choosing violence this week.
My good friend calling in from the high country up in Colorado. I just love this jam. My good friend Trevor Groves is on the phone. And he's going to be telling us about a trip that he just took up to the Northwest Territories, chasing doll sheep, some interactions with caribou, sounds like grizzly bears. I'm really excited for this one. First of all, Trevor, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It feels like this is a trip that I have been anticipating for several years, and I didn't even get to go on it. How long have you been putting this thing together for?
Man, it's funny enough, I was actually just doing the math before we got on. So I originally booked this in the spring of 2021 for hunt dates in 2023. And then I told my cousin about it, and he was like, well, I want to go. And so being the nice guy that I am, contacted the outfitter and he said, well, we're full for 2023 to add another hunter, so we got to push you out a year. So it's been like well over, you know, a thousand days of just preparation, waiting, like anticipation, and like it's all come together and it's done. And there's just so much to unpack from it all. It just feels like, you know, a part of my life has kind of moved on from that because there was so much buildup and anticipation leading up to it.
How do you even begin preparing for something like that? Between, you know, trying to get in physical shape, trying to accumulate the type of gear that you're going to need, fundraising, just the anticipation of it all. I don't know where I would even begin in preparation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. And for me, it was, and kind of talking with some people who had done it before, they said, like, start with the experience that you want. And for us, like, we wanted this to not only just be about like going out and harvesting an animal, we kind of wanted it to suck a little bit. We wanted it to like, we wanted to work for it and have to, you know, put in the time and the effort. And there's a few different like ways that you can go about doing a hunt like this. You can, obviously you can use horses. There's outfitters that use helicopters to kind of just like, you know, pick you up and drop you off on top of the mountain. And then there's kind of the old school method of doing it where they take you in on a bush plane and they land you in a flat spot. You take a backpack and you hike. And for us, like that was more of what we wanted to try and associate with and have from this experience was like a traditional sort of backpack style hunt where everywhere we wanted to go was under our two feet.
Hmm. Tell me a little bit about the gear that you took with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously for being a backpack hunt, like weight was everything. So preparing for this, it was like putting together gear lists and thinking, you know, through like, is this absolutely critical for me to basically survive in the wilderness? And it was a 15-day hunt. And with that, we carried with us the first kind of stint of the hunt, about 11 days worth of food. So right there, just the sheer size of carrying that much food with you is like a big concern. So weight obviously is very, very critical. I mean, it was minimalist, 3 pairs of underwear, 3 pairs of socks, 1 pair of pants, 2 shirts, like everything was kind of rationalized to the nth degree. And then it came down to like trying to save space. So it was trying to think about, you know, the biggest, you know, the backpack that wasn't going to be too big. So I took like a 7,200 cubic inch backpack and, you know, did a whole bunch of test packs and making sure that my gear was as lightweight and as, you know, space efficient as possible. And then thinking about, well, how am I going to actually, you know, carry a rifle and a spotting scope and all the other sort of equipment that you need to be successful out there. So it was kind of just piecemealing it through. And I'm actually thankful that I had that 3-year wait period because it allowed me to go through and really get dialed and, you know, change some things out and test some things. And it just turned into like a, I want to call it like an obsession almost, of just trying to get as efficient and as dialed as possible.
How about your physical training? I'm sure when you're thinking, what elevation were you hunting at up in the McKenzies for starters? And I know you live at altitude now, but what all did you try to do to actually physically prepare for this?
Yeah. And that was a big piece of it too. And they said, you know, in the preparation and kind of the first contact with the outfitter was like, make sure that you can shoot and that you're in shape. Those are the two things that they said. So kind of taking their advice, it was, you know, doing a lot of rucking. So just carrying a backpack with weight. I subscribe to popular kind of fitness for geared towards mountain hunting with the Mountain Tough program. Can't say enough good things about that. I'm actually still running with it. It's just, it's an amazing program and really gets you prepared. And doing that for the first, you know, 6 months leading up to the hunt got me in the shape that I needed to be. And just, you know, living at altitude was helpful as well. So we weren't as high as we were in Colorado. We started at about 1,000 feet in base camp, and the mountains there top out at about 7,000. So not super high in terms of altitude, but the sheer elevation change that you're doing, you know, a lot of times multiple times a day trying to get up and down to these sheep made it just a pretty physically demanding hunt.
And I know I've seen the pins because you sent me some Onyx locations, but for our listeners, can you try to describe where you were hunting?
Yeah. So if you think about kind of the Rocky Mountains and they're leading all the way up into the northern part of Canada, you go to the very, very top north section of where the Rockies like peter out and it goes into the Arctic Circle. That is where our outfitter was. So it's the kind of the farthest north concession and a part of a, you know, series of other outfitters that operate in the Northwest Territories. So it's Arctic Red River Outfitters. You know, they have a 100-mile by 100-mile square concession. So to put that in perspective, it's 10,000 square miles that they have rights to outfit on. And just the sheer size of the country is kind of unfathomable. So we're at the very top of the Rockies, and that's where they operate out of, basically from about mid-July through October.
I know that with the mass consumption of wild spaces today, it's getting harder and harder to find untouched pieces of ground. But it has to feel when you're up in a place like that, Trevor, that, I mean, you've got to feel like you're the only person that's ever stood in that place and looked at that. It's just got to be pristine, untouched country.
Yeah, it's... We, you know, those bush planes drop you off and it's just silence. I mean, we heard one commercial plane go over and we actually looked at it. We were like, I wonder what this is. Like, where is it going? It's going from like the East Coast into Fairbanks, Alaska every day. And that was the only commercial jet that we would hear go over. And it would like stop us in our tracks. We'd say like, oh my gosh, we heard a plane, because you don't hear any human interaction, or like, you know, it's untouched by the hands of humans. And it's pretty unfathomable. Like I got chills just kind of talking about it. It's pretty, pretty special experience.
And I know you carried a Garmin inReach, and I know you sent me a couple of updates periodically, but it probably easy to just feel like the real world ceases to exist for that 15 day period.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. And it kind of took a little bit of time to just get in that groove of like, yeah, you don't have to be at this kind of pace that we're at in our normal lives of rushing everywhere and, you know, having your headphones in and you're like hearing is kind of off. You start to kind of get more in tune with just the natural world around you, and the smells get heightened and your sight gets better, and just all these little things that we started to notice. And it took a few days to kind of get into a groove, but amazing how quickly we adapted. And then coming back out of it was a little bit of a culture shock too, but just loved every minute of it.
One of my favorite Emerson quotes, Ralph Waldo Emerson, is adopt the pace of nature. Her secret is patience. That's something that I think of when I, and as you know, in the real world today, we don't get many opportunities to just immerse ourselves in wild spaces. But when you can do that for an extended period of time, it's amazing how long it takes you to really slow down, but how deeply connected you can start to feel with things that you just overlook in your day to day.
100%.
I'm going to set you up a little bit here. I want you to tell us about the travel itself, getting there. And what happened with your gear?
Yeah. So it's funny. I think one of the most difficult pieces of this whole experience was the travel. And what was most frustrating about it, it was kind of like the one thing that wasn't within our control. Like, sure, we could set our flight schedules and try and pack in buffers and, you know, make sure we're not making too tight of connections. But it was a journey, man. And just to get into the wilderness was five flights. So our first flight, we left from our home. So Colorado, and my cousin who joined was coming from Minneapolis. So we met in Calgary. And that's kind of where things went off the rails. I had a 3-hour connection. My cousin had a 7-hour connection in Calgary before we kind of go farther north into Yellowknife and get our bags off and clear customs in Calgary and basically go back to the commercial jet to kind of recheck our bags. And I mean, just an absolute disorganized mess. It's like they had never seen hunting gear or rifles or anything before, which is kind of surprising for a place like that. But ended up having my gun make it through the oversized baggage check, and then my duffel bag with all of my gear, all of my food, rain gear, everything got held up and was left in Calgary. So the choice from the outfitter was, hey, let's just keep you moving forward. Like, don't stop your travel itinerary. It's better to get humans where they need to be, and we can kind of sort the gear out later. So I ended up leaving Yellowknife without my duffel, going to a smaller kind of, or like last taste of civilization was this little town called Norman Wells. And then there we got on a charter flight, with a little outfit called North Right Air. And they flew us into the Arctic Red base camp. And then from there, still didn't have my bag when I made it to base camp. And they decided that day to fly us out into the wilderness. So ended up scrounging together like a spare set of rain gear and a puffy jacket and some gaiters, and had a gun with no bullets, like all this thing. And I'm just flown out in a Super Cub airplane into the wilderness. But, you know, we made the most of it. And I think that's what, you know, this trip taught us, is kind of just like roll with the punches a little bit. And to be honest, like those first few days of the hunt were some of the best we had had. So had we not been out there, I don't think we would have gotten the experience, or certainly like the level of excitement that we had. And we just made it work. And turns out like they were able to kind of make the handoffs with the bags. And by day three of the hunt, they were able to get my duffel bag into me and make the changeover, and I could kind of swap out all my gear. But it's just funny, like you do all this preparation and you have everything so dialed, and the one thing you can't control is how that bag moves through the airline system. But we made it work.
And what a valuable life lesson and perspective that is for us, right? On whether you're talking trying to get your hunting gear up to the Northwest Territories, or you know, you're working on purchasing life insurance for your family or anything like this, right? Like, there's so many unforeseen things in our human experience, and we try so hard to strangle the things that we can control. And sometimes the most beautiful things that happen are in those areas of just, man, we got to make the most of whatever this is, right? We got a lot more ahead, though. Excited to have Trevor join us for the rest of the episode. Some caribou encounters, grizzly bears, doll sheep hunting ahead inside the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
You're listening to The Outdoor Hour with your host Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside The Outdoor Hour. Taylor Maples, Joshua Wildman Stratton, the one and only Maddie Goldfish. And on the phone this week, my good friend Trevor Groves calling from Colorado, talking to us about his experience for 2 weeks up in the Northwest Territories, the Northern Rockies chasing doll sheep. In the previous segment, Trevor, you kind of explained the travel getting there, how treacherous it was, your preparation. Let's just assume now you've landed, you're at base camp. So many years of anticipation, such a wild, untouched piece of wilderness. What's it like to step off that plane in the Northwest Territories?
Yeah. It's almost got this like celebrity sort of vibe to it, where you see someone that you've kind of anticipated or thought you've known, and you've seen pictures and videos of this place, and there's this famous like welcome to Arctic Red River Outfitter sign that everyone takes a photo of, and like to see it in person and like step off that plane was pretty special. But the crazy part is like they waste no time. So like you get there and they throw you right into preparations and getting your pack situated. And if the weather is good, like they want to try and get you into the field as quickly as possible. So we only spent probably a couple hours in base camp just getting prepared, and they flew us out that same night into the field on a couple of Super Cub airplanes. So it's like a two-seater. You sit right behind the pilot with your rifle between your legs and your backpack behind you, and they fly you into the field. And once you're there, you have to wait 12 hours. So just a kind of a turn of the calendar so that, you're not kind of hunting the same day that you're flying. It's just, you can't fly over animals and spot them. That's kind of the thought process behind that. So we started our clock, and the next morning we were able to wake up and start hunting, which was great.
Man. I don't even know where to begin. Like, that's just such a you put so much time and energy and money and thought into this. Josh, you've got some thoughts. I can see those wheels turning.
I felt like for you, I just assumed the first thing you were thinking about was bears. And probably wanted to know, hey, what was your bear protection plan? What were you packing? I know I'm about to roll out to Raspberry Island there north of Kodiak on Monday myself, and that's a I actually picked up a new SIG X10 for that trip,
for that very reason. And that's a great point. I want to hear about your bear plans, Trevor, but you also mentioned you're carrying 11 days worth of food, and my understanding of the terrain up there is it's not like you're creating bear bags strung between big tall trees, right?
Correct. Yeah, so you're going into a lot more bear-infested areas on Kodiak. For us, thankfully, like the terrain was fairly open. Like, think about it as sort of high alpine. You had some kind of low, like it was actually blueberry bushes that were all around us. So you could just reach down whenever you wanted and just get like a handful of blueberries and just eat them. So you can see why the bears love it. But for our protection plan, like it was really pretty bare bones, like because we were crossing from the United States into Canada, we
don't
had
die.
To,
go ahead.
We had to actually, declare all of our firearms. So I didn't bring a handgun. I just carried my rifle, and we had it, basically at the repeat as we were, kind of trucking around the wilderness. And the guides, obviously, they carried lever action 45-70s. So they were ready to go, but for us, like we weren't doing bear bags, we didn't have any trees to hang it on, so it was just kind of keep everything close. And then when we did end up harvesting, we'd actually bury the meat in moss to try and just minimize the amount of scent and blood and things like that were getting into the air, just to try and prevent any encounters. But as soon as we stepped off that plane, a sow and a cub, like 1,000 yards away, we were able to see them with our naked eye. So it's like, we're not in Kansas anymore. It's real.
Yeah. You guys had some early success though, hunting, right?
We did. Yeah. So that first day we ended up, our two guides, I have to mention them quick, is Al Clausen and his son, Derek Clausen. So two very well-known names in the kind of sheep community. And between these guys, 200 rams that they've helped to guide. So we were in very capable hands, and, you know, it was kind of like, again, hunting with a celebrity almost, but they took us on, I would call it like an interview, to see like, okay, are these guys actually prepared? And it was a 10-mile grinder through, you know, some a real steep basin. They took us up on top, took us through some boulder fields, and then dropped us down upstream from our camp. And as we kind of crested off the hill and came down into the valley, picked up just a stud caribou. And he was about 1,000 yards away, and we were able to, you know, make a quick judgment on him that, yeah, this is a caribou that's worth, you know, harvesting early on in the hunt. Usually they try to prioritize sheep, but given that we were, you know, basically on day one, it was like, let's make a play on it. So because I didn't have any bullets for my gun, my cousin got first right, and moved in and got to within 250 yards of this caribou, and he made a just fantastic shot, and that was our harvest on day one. It's a 10-mile loop, and then we ended up harvesting the caribou and packed him back to camp 3 miles downriver, and that was our first experience of Arctic Red River. So it delivered on day one.
I'm sure to a degree, you've got to just be pinching yourself at that point, because, like you said, it takes you a few days to kind of slough off the real world. And in a 24-hour period, you've gone from getting on an airplane at Denver International Airport to now you're all the way up in the Northwest Territories, the McKenzie Range, to you're on a 10-mile ruck. And, oh, by the way, my cousin just harvested a massive caribou. I'm sure as you're breaking down this animal, you just kind of have to be looking around saying, like, where are we? Like, is this real life?
Yeah, absolutely. We had this kind of saying that we were just – pinching ourselves the whole way through the trip. And it was just kind of like, you know, stop and smell the roses and just, you know, think about where we are and try to just commit every possible thing that we're seeing to memory, because it was happening fast.
So I know there's a lot of exciting stuff still to talk about from your 15-day trip, but day one, you've done that 10-mile trip, your cousins harvested a caribou. What kind of things do you remember from your stopping and smelling the roses that far in the trip? What stands out to you?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like that first morning, just waking up and you kind of unzip the fly in your tent and you poke your head out and you're just surrounded by this just amphitheater of mountains. And it's kind of unlike any mountain range, you know, that I've seen in Colorado. There's no trees on them. So you get to see all the geology and these bright oranges and really deep grays, and just the colors around were unfathomable. You know, it rained every day, so we were getting like really cool atmosphere kind of moving in and out of the mountains with these low-lying clouds kind of dipping over the peaks and things, and it just brought the whole thing into perspective. And then to kind of get the added benefit of, you know, you got wild blueberries that surround you and you're not filtering water. That was kind of a wild, you know, reality check, as you just dip down into the stream with your Nalgene bottle, fill it up and drink it. Like, not something you can do in the lower 48 unless you want to flirt with Giardia. So yeah. A really, really pretty cool experience there.
Even at the low altitude that you guys were at, that was okay, huh?
Yeah, amazingly. And it's just, you know, they've never had a problem with it. And they said, please don't bring a water filter, because it's just, you're not going to use it and it's more weight.
Wow. Unbelievable. Yeah. We talked a little bit already about the weather. I've never been up that far north, but the one thing that seems to always be a theme is you've got to just expect that it's going to suck for a lot of the trip. Was that your experience?
Yeah. And it was more of like a mixed bag. Like every day we'd get a little bit of sunshine. We'd get rain every day. It was almost like a kind of a rainforest where you would get these rainstorms that would come through, and you just, again, kind of the theme was you just kind of had to roll with it and have your rain gear on at the ready and be prepared to just be wet all the time. Like, you know, you're crossing creeks and you're going through moss and your boots are constantly wet, but you, again, your body just kind of adapts and understands that, hey, this is the reality that I'm living in now. And you know, just soak in those sunny moments when the sun hits your face, just kind of stop there and poke your head up and take in the sun on your face. It's kind of makes you appreciate all the different changes in the weather.
What other kind of wildlife did you guys run into?
Well, did see some wolves, like a lot of them. We actually saw more wolves than we did grizzly bears. So the first day we actually saw, as we were packing my cousin's caribou out, we saw three wolves hunting a separate herd of caribou and saw one, start to make a play on them. So that was, we did have wolf tags with us. That's kind of part of the package that, you kind of sign up for when you go to hunt in the Northwest Territories is you buy tags for wolverines, for wolves. You can't hunt bears, just given where we're at, but you get doll sheep and caribou. So they expect that kind of if you see one, the idea is to try and make a harvest on them just because there is no real population management. Like not many residents hunt these areas. And, you know, the caribou population fluctuates, one, with winters a lot, but then wolf populations and when herds and packs kind of move in and out of different areas, it's kind of feast and famine. So the first day we ended up seeing those wolves. And as we were back at camp on day two, caping out a caribou, we had another wolf come in, two actually, and they were right across from our camp. So we were able to make a quick play on them and sprint across a creek in our boots. And we got soaked in the process, but closed the distance into 250 yards and ended up having a double harvest on a couple of wolves. And I know it's, for us, we kind of rationalized it as we're kind of doing our part of conservation. We took a really old caribou bull out of the population. And for us, we took two wolves out as well, because we were watching them hunt other ungulates. And for us, like this felt like the right thing to do. And, we're kind of pleased in the whole experience.
And I know that can be a very polarizing topic in today's world, and we don't need to get too far into it, but what I do want to focus in on is what an unbelievable experience you got to have for 15 days, just seeing a piece of the globe that not many people ever get to, interacting in their natural environments with some very, very cool predators and prey species. I mean, it's just, I've been following along with you're releasing some stuff and photos on social media in such a cool way. I love the way that you're telling that story. I can't wait to continue to see how that plays out and how it really ends. I know that the purpose of your trip was doll sheep hunting, and yeah, we haven't even gotten to the doll sheep stuff. So yeah, we're going to have to do that in the next segment. Before we send it to a break, though, I got to ask, why doll sheep?
Yeah, I'm trying to answer that for myself, and I think it's become sort of this pinnacle of like what I want to become as a hunter. And I grew up whitetail hunting in Wisconsin with my dad. Like that's where I learned. And so same with my cousin. Like it was our dads that introduced us to this, and we've just kind of progressively the pursuit of different species, whether it's mule deer or elk or mountain goat, like they've taken us to these places that creates an experience. Like it's not about the harvest. I know that's why we're out there, is to pursue these animals, but really it's about the places that they take you. And for me, like when I think about some of the wildest places in North America, I think about where doll sheep live and where, these animals, what they survive and what they thrive in, is places that, like you said, very few people are ever going to step foot. And to me, that is like the ultimate sort of adventure and something that I'm willing to put, a lot of time and resources and money into to try and experience. And to me, it was not about like, I would have been perfectly happy to come home without a sheep. Certainly I wanted that to happen, but just being out there and experiencing that environment is incredible. And that to me was why I wanted to pursue them.
That's super cool. Let's squeeze in a break. I plugged your social media, just teasing it. Do you mind if I give your handle away here?
Yeah, no, not at all.
Why don't you go ahead and do it actually?
Yeah, it's Talon Groves.
Yeah, TAllen_Groves on Instagram. There is a bunch of, your wildlife photography and stuff is just awesome to begin with. But especially this little series it appears you're doing on how you're telling the story and releasing some of your images from this trip. Truly, like I've been on the edge of my seat just waiting on the next post that you make for the last week and a half or so.
Thanks, man. I'm trying to just like kind of draw it out and like tell the story, because as we'll see in the next segment here, like we didn't actually see any rams until a week into our trip.
Man, what an experience. You mentioned you wanted to kind of suffer through it a little bit. It sounds like that happened. Did you ever reach a point when you said, all right, I'm tired of waiting, let's go find some rams?
No, surprisingly. And kind of the guides actually said that. It's like, you guys are actually being really patient. And I think, you know, we went in with the right, I'm not saying like, we went in with the attitude of, we just want to experience the country, like we had kind of talked about here just a little bit ago. And for us, it was like every new valley was like the anticipation that, oh, there could potentially be sheep anywhere. Like that to me is super exciting. So the pace of it all, and knowing that we had, again, 2 weeks to get this done, we weren't really stressed about it. And we just kind of trusted the process and knew that patience and persistence kills. And for us, like that couldn't have come more to fruition on this hunt.
I love that. I'm tired of being patient, though. I want to talk about Dall sheep. We're going to do it on the other side of this break. Stay with us on the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Now, back to the Outdoor Hour with your hosts, Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside the Outdoor Hour. Taylor Maples, Joshua Wildman, Stratton, Maddie Goldfish, and my good friend Trevor Groves on the phone. We're talking Dall sheep hunting this week, something I would love to get to go do. More reasonable for me, though, right now, and especially this time of year, is I'm going to get my rear end over to Arkansas and do some fly fishing. Before I do that, every time I stop into J.D. Adams and Company, and I completely outfit myself from, you know, the gear that I need, whether that's new fly lines, some flies, any new leaders, tippet, all of that kind of stuff. I'm still on the market for a new spool, so I need to talk with somebody over there about that spool for my grande. Anyways, or whether I'm looking for some new apparel. I know you guys have a ton of stuff over there, Josh. I love the Howler stuff. I'm really hooked on those new poncho shirts right now. It's a good time of year for those.
Oh, yeah, it's perfect. For UOU fans, is a great crimson-y colored checkered plaid Orvis River Guide shirt.
Cool.
Rocked that to the game 2 weeks ago. Got lots of compliments of people sitting around me saying, oh, man, that's great. Like, where'd you get that? And
J.D. Adams and Company.
That's right.
Northwest corner of 122nd and North May Avenue. You know, somebody asked
Giant
me recently.
Giant sign that says fly shop. Can't miss it.
Somebody asked me where J.D. Adams is, and I said, it's on the northwest corner of 122nd and North May. And they kind of looked at me like, that seemed rehearsed. And I said, yeah, I've said it once or twice.
Once or twice.
Go see the guys at J.D. Adams and Company. Check it out. All right, Trevor, the anticipation is killing me. We've been talking about Dall sheep hunting. You've spent about a week at this point in your story up in the McKenzie Range, Northwest Territories. I know you're pursuing sheep. I know you hadn't really been seeing sheep. What was your experience like chasing Dall sheep, and how did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah, it lived up to every expectation that I wanted. It drug out in terms of just the process and the work to try and find them. You know, a lot of outfits will fly their areas and try and scout for where sheep are and kind of place you into drainages where they know there's going to be rams. This outfitter didn't do that. It was truly like a hunting experience. We had to go and dig them up out of these basins and cliffs and craggy ridges and stuff. It was everything that I wanted. And we're a week into our hunt and we had seen one band of ewes and lambs, but no rams with them. So we made a big push. And that's kind of where they designed this hunt around us, is they wanted us to kind of systematically work through a series of drainages that, you know, they had known that there were sheep that typically were in those areas. But we had gone a week through this country and not seen any, and it's amazing how quickly things can change. And we woke up one morning and decided to move our camp downriver a little bit and kind of poke into this next basin. sure enough, we turn the corner. It's called Rumbly is the area that they had called it. And we turn the corner into this area and start kind of climbing up to gain some elevation in hopes to find a flat place to camp. Immediately pick up two sheep just sitting up on a high point, and knew right away that they were rams. Like, you could see from a distance, they're probably 1500 yards away, but just dark, you know, full curl on one of them. And the other ram that was with them was much younger, but they call them banana rams because it looks like two bananas on top of their heads. But pulled up the spotting scope. We hadn't even set camp. We just threw our backpacks down and, you know, all hands on deck. And sure enough, that was the sheep that we wanted to pursue. So the next plan was like, okay, let's put a game plan together to try and get up to them. They were about 2,000 feet above us. So we quickly set up camp. And as we were doing that, these sheep were smart. Like, they saw us setting up camp and saw the tents go up, and they got up and fed over the backside of this ridge. And we said, perfect, let's get up there, and we'll hopefully just be able to poke over a ridge and find embedded or, you know, feeding and make a nice, you know, relaxed shot. Couldn't have been farther from the truth of what actually ended up happening. We got up there and we started, you know, again, kind of poking over each one of the ridge. And before you'd get up to a fold in the mountain, you'd kind of peek over and look over just to see, like, okay, we're, you know, expecting to see a sheep there. And we did that probably five or six times in the last little fold in the mountain before we were going to kind of double back and see if they dropped in below us. We look above us, which we weren't expecting, and see my ram with the ram that he was with kind of running through this boulder field about 300 yards above us. And that's when the rodeo commenced. So it was drop the pack, get the gun out, dial your scope. I put it at 320 yards just to be safe. We got a range on it and try to get to a somewhat flat spot to try and basically make a 45-degree angle shot up at this ram. And it was, it happened so, so fast. And you just kind of blink and you go into this like autopilot mode where you've practiced, you've shot at distance, you've, you know your equipment. And for me, it was just like, okay, dial the scope, pull down the legs on my bipod, get to a spot where I can lay prone. And I made a shot at 320 yards. And I mean, that was how I harvested my sheep. And you kind of stop and think about this moment that's lived for so long in your mind and in your dreams, and to have it happen like that was not, you know, originally what I thought. But now looking back, I can't imagine it any other way. So it just added to the whole experience that it was a little bit of a rodeo and a lot of, you know, craziness that perspired and a, you know, basically a 5-minute time frame. But that was it.
What do you remember feeling during that rodeo?
Again, it was kind of like I sort of like blacked out. Senses are heightened. I was just like following the animal. I had it in the scope the whole time as he was like, I was waiting for him to stop, and I got a sort of hard quartering away shot, but it was able to kind of thread the needle right in to where it needed to be. But after the shot is when just this flood of emotions came over me. And, you know, I don't like to show emotion, but, you know, basically just like kind of like what just happened. And, you know, you think about all the people that have supported you in getting there, and your wife and your family and your friends, and to have this all come together like this was just, yeah, that's really when it hit me afterwards was, wow, like gratitude.
I've seen the pictures of your ram laying up there in the gravel field. It certainly looks like the Northwest Territories up across that yeah. massive canyon. What's it like to walk up on that kind of an animal and lay hands on it for the first time?
Unbelievable. Yeah, it was, you realize how heavy the horns are. That was my first impression. I didn't expect it, but the skull plate and the horns on my ram, he was 11 years old. We aged him. And that was another big part of the outfit that I chose, was they want to try and harvest the oldest rams they possibly can. And 10 years old is the minimum age that they try to shoot for. And we crested that, and we got an 11-year-old ram. And to pick the horns up, 18 pounds of just horn is a lot. And you just look at their coat and everything about them, their hooves, they're just so purpose built for where they live. It was pretty incredible. And honestly, a little foreign to what we experienced down in the lower 48, like dealing with deer and elk and things like that and pronghorn. It's just so different. So it was an incredible experience.
We're starting to get close on time here. We got about 5 minutes left in the show. But I know your cousin had a chance to harvest a doll sheep as well. What was that like?
Yeah. So his experience then, you know, a week later, so we had packed my ram out. We had the planes come in and pick up my cape and horns and fly it out. And then we hiked into a new drainage, a whole new basin. His was also, you know, a great experience where we ended up seeing 12 rams on one hillside. But the problem was getting close to his. Again, another 11-year-old ram, some really smart, really cagey, and just trying to get in close to where these sheep would let us get a shot was a challenge. And we spent, you know, one whole day, like a full like 12-hour day chasing these sheep up and down and up and down, like doing multiple thousands of feet of vertical elevation change. And we could never get on them. And that was like an emotionally draining process. And we ended up naming this ram the Magician because he would just disappear and then he would reappear in a whole different area. And so the next day we were able to pick him up in an entirely new basin. And we ended up making a play up and climbed up to get on his same kind of elevation plane. Closest we could get was 510 yards. And my cousin made just a phenomenal shot. Like, I mean, he was just so well prepared and made that shot on a very ethical, you know, harvest on that animal. And I couldn't be more proud of him. And after that, I mean, we all let it loose on that one. We're all just up there on the mountain, just weeping because we had gone through another 7 days of just grinding, like going through rain and, you know, lots of hiking and dealing with all sorts of emotions of thinking we had him in a place where we'd be able to harvest them and then not. Like 14 with 1 day left in the hunt and weather moving in, so who knows if we were even going to be able to hunt the next day. Like, it was pretty surreal. And I mean, to both get sheep on a 15-day hunt is an accomplishment. And we can't wait to do it again. It's just, the sheep bug is real. Once you get it, it's like you either want to go back and do it again or you never want to do it again. But we're definitely ready to do it again.
How do you come back home after something like that? I know you said that it was hard to kind of reintroduce yourself into the real world, but I just have to imagine you feel like a totally different person after an experience like that.
Yeah, spot on. Like, it's, you're... The things that you worry about every day feel kind of trivial in a way. It's like, you know, stuff's happening at work and you're like, man, is this really like a make or break thing? Or should I really be stressed about this? And you think about the experience you've just had. And to me, like, it's put a lot in perspective on just, you know, what's important in life and strive for. And it's a life-changing experience. And to try and have people in my life that want to hear the story and, you know, share that with me I'm very blessed. So tickled to be back, but ready to be back in the mountains as well.
Well, man, I hate to do it, but we're pretty much at the end of our time slot here. We're going to have you on again. We'll plug your social media one more time. Talon_Groves, spelled like Talon_Groves on Instagram. If you want to see some of Trevor's photos, and he's written some really cool so far. There are 4 parts of this, and they're still only up to the searching for sheep portion of his story on Instagram. But he's written some really cool words. There's some unbelievable photos on Instagram, Talon_Groves. If you want to go check it out there, we'll share some of that on the outdoor page, outdoor hour page as well. Outdoor_hour on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can follow Joshua Wildman Stratton at @against_current on Instagram. You can see me at @T_Maples. Man, Trevor, thank you for just in a brief period sharing a little bit about this story with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on. And just again, so thankful and so gracious to have people to share this with.
Listeners, also don't forget about the Shootout Cancer Clay Shoot coming up at Cedar Gate at the end of the month. Check out our socials for more information on that. If you're interested in participating or sponsor, reach out to us on social and we will get you connected with the right people. But it's going to be a great event. first year for it and come raise some money for the Hope Lodge here in Oklahoma City. And while you're at it, enjoy some camaraderie with other people who love blasting some clays and getting ready for hunting season.
Yep, that is September 30th at Cedar Gate. There you go. Trevor, once again, thank you for joining us. Trevor Groves from Colorado, telling stories from the McKenzie Range, doll sheep hunting, caribou. Man, just unbelievable stuff.
Unreal.
Unreal. I got to get up that way.
But it's all real.
It's all real. It's all real wild.
It's all real. Maybe the rest of what we're doing is unreal.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. We got to go. This has been the Outdoor Hour. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week. Until then, go boldly. We'll see you outdoors.